You're listening to 90 Day Soulmate with the relationship engineers, Jim Golnick and Lisette Guevara, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to 90 Day Soulmate. Today we're talking about beyond the lab. What are we really measuring? We're talking about an article that is a brand new paper. It's from the Research Association magazine, the American Psychological Association. The title of the research paper was called Emotions Beyond the Lab. At first I thought this week's show would be about emotions. But after a few pages of reading this research paper, I found myself thinking something much bigger was afoot. How do we know what we know, especially during psychological research? It's not just a question, it's the foundation of every science. Medicine asks it, engineering asks it, economics asks it. Every one of us asks if every time we decide what to believe. Every day we hear phrases like, research shows, studies prove, scientists have discovered. But how often do we stop and ask, what exactly did they measure? This may sound like a small question, but it's actually where good science begins. Measure the wrong thing, and even perfect data can lead to the wrong conclusion. This paper argues that psychologists are moving beyond the laboratory to study emotions where they naturally occur. In everyday life. That's really exciting, but it also raises another question. If emotions are difficult to measure inside a carefully controlled laboratory, what happens when we step into the wonderfully messy reality of everyday life? That's where I'd like today's show to begin. Before we define anything, before we talk about any single psychological term, let's start with something everyone understands. Suppose I wanted to know what today's temperature is. I could ask 10 people, hey, how warm do you feel? Or I could look at a thermometer. Now here's the interesting part. Neither one is necessarily wrong, right? The thermometer measures temperature, but the people measure their experience of the temperature. Cold, hot, those are subjective views, right? There are two different types of measurements. One answers the quantity or quantitative, and the other is more qualitative. Keeping that thought in the back of your mind, because psychology faces the exact same challenge every day. The paper we're discussing comes from a field called affective science. Don't let that name intimidate you. It's simply the science of studying emotions. Where do emotions come from anyway? Why do they change? How do they influence our decisions and our behavior? Unlike temperature, however, emotions don't come with a built-in thermometer. So, psychologists estimate them, right? They ask questions, they observe, they look at the behavior, they measure physiology and other types of responses in the body, and sometimes they combine all three. Which brings us right back to our original question. What exactly are we measuring? So you need data, evidence, proof. So one thing I've noticed over the years is that people often use these three words as though they mean exactly the same thing. Data, evidence, proof. Are they really the same thing? I don't think so. So data is just information. Evidence is information that supports or challenges an idea, maybe a theory. And proof, that's a word scientists should use very carefully. Good science doesn't become true because someone published a paper. Good science becomes stronger because other scientists continue asking better questions. They question the results. This paper contained a lot of data. It has plenty of it. But that's not what interests me. What interested me in this is finding something much more fundamental. Do we actually measure what we think we measured? Or did we simply measure something that looks similar? Because every conclusion, no matter how sophisticated we try to present it, rests on that one simple foundation. Ecological validity. What the heck does that mean to me? If someone tells you a study proved something, ask one simple question. How closely did that study resemble real life? A good laboratory study and a good real-world study may answer different questions. Let's look at one of the definitions that was introduced in the paper. It's called ecological validity. It sounds intimidating, but the idea is really simple. Imagine learning to fly an airplane. Would you rather practice in a simulator or during an actual thunderstorm? Hopefully both. The simulator gives you control. Real life gives you reality. Psychologists use the term ecological validity to discover how closely an experiment represents what actually happens in everyday life. Laboratories are wonderful places for science. Researchers control temperature, lighting, distractions, timing, and dozens of other variables so they can isolate one thing at a time. But real life refuses to cooperate. Real life introduces poor sleep, family problems, financial stress, unexpected phone calls, traffic, hunger, 1,000 other variables that laboratory work very hard to eliminate. The authors of this paper aren't saying laboratories are bad. They're saying that if we really want to understand human emotions, eventually we have to study people where they actually live. And that's exactly where the science starts becoming harder and much more interesting. So, again, laboratory or real life? Well, let's be fair. Laboratories exist for a reason, and they're incredibly important. Imagine trying to discover whether a new medication works. If every patient eats different foods, sleeps different hours, exercises different amounts, and lives under different conditions, it becomes very difficult to know what actually caused the result. That's why scientists love laboratories. They can control as many variables as possible. They can isolate the experiment. This leads them to being able to change one variable at a time, and that makes for good science. But here's the trade-off. The more control we create, the further we sometimes move away from real life, from reality. Years ago, I wrote a paper discussing bird-safe glass. The industry developed what's called a tunnel test. Birds fly through this carefully tailored controlled tunnel towards different glass configurations, one on the left, one on the right. It's a fast test. The bird either goes left or right, and it's repeatable, it's standardized, and it produces tons of useful data. But here's the question that ended up bothering me. Does flying through a tunnel really represent what birds experience outside in real life? Laboratory tests are excellent for answering the questions they were designed to answer. The danger comes when we assume they answer the questions they were never designed to answer. Psychology faces exactly the same challenge. When we test a bird in a tunnel, the results are for the test in the tunnel. Doesn't mean it can be generalized to the outside environment. So another thing we see is something called self-reports. What does this mean to me? The next time someone asks, how are you feeling? Remember that your answer may be describing not only your emotion, but also your interpretation of that emotion. One of the most common tools in psychology is called a self-report. It's wonderfully simple. Researchers ask people what they're thinking and what they're feeling or what they've experienced. At first, it sounds pretty reasonable. After all, who knows you and how you're feeling better than you do? But I'd like you to think about something. When someone asks, how are you feeling? Does the answer come directly from the emotion, or does something happen first? Do you think about your answer? Do you compare it with past experiences? Wonder who's asking and why they're asking? How your answer might be received by that person? Maybe you're embarrassed. Maybe you're angry. Maybe you're disappointed. Maybe you're just confused. I don't think most people intentionally lie, but I think something much more interesting happens. Between the emotion and the answer, there may be a journey that your mind takes. The event occurs, your body reacts, your subconscious begins processing. Your conscious mind starts assigning meaning, then memory, personality, self-image, social expectations all begin shaping the answer you eventually give. By the time the researcher records your response, has the original emotion already been filtered? A lot. I don't know the answer, but it's an important question. Because if self-reports are measuring emotion after interpretation, what happens when the body tells a different story? When the body doesn't agree with what the person is saying, what does this mean to me? Well, your body may recognize something before your conscious mind does. In fact, it does typically. A racing heart isn't always fear. It may be excitement, anticipation, or simply preparation for action. One study discussed in this paper really captured my attention. Researchers measured two things at the same time. They asked participants what they were feeling while also measuring physiological responses, including electrodermal activity. It's a complicated name for something really simple. When your nervous system becomes activated, tiny changes occur in the electrical conductivity on your skin. They can measure these things pretty accurately. And here's what surprised me is that the physiological measurements didn't necessarily match the participant's self-report. In other words, the body appeared to be telling one story while the conscious mind reported something different. How they said they were feeling versus what was actually happening. Now, let's be careful. It doesn't mean the body was right or it was measured correctly and that the person was wrong. They could be measuring different parts of the same experience. The body reacts, the mind interprets. Then we decide what we're willing or even able to report. That one observation may be the most fascinating part of the entire paper to me. It leads to a question I don't think psychology has completely answered. When physiology and self-report disagree, which one are we really trying to measure? What does it mean? The missing piece. Well, let's put everything together. Suppose researchers asked 100 people how they're feeling. At the same time, they measure the heart rate, skin conductivity, breathing, perhaps even brain activity. Now, suppose those measurements don't always agree. What do we conclude? Do we trust the physiology or do we trust the self-report? Or do we conclude that they're measuring different parts of the same experience? I could look at a third explanation. Perhaps physiology measures what the body is doing, while self-reports measure what the conscious mind believes or chooses to report. Those are not necessarily the same thing. I'm thinking cognitive dissonance in this case. Think about everything that happens before you answer a simple question. Your memory influences you, personality influences you, as we talked about, social expectations influence you, embarrassment could influence what you say. Even today's cultural climate can influence you. You don't want to hurt someone's feelings or have someone angry at you. By the time the researcher hears your answer, has the original emotion already been filtered? It's a fascinating question, and it's one that researchers don't really spend that much time thinking about, from my point of view. I'd like to spend the next 90 seconds asking questions, not giving answers. What if emotions occur before conscious awareness? You know, we talk about them being innate in us, survival of the fittest, a lot of these emotions are there already. What if the body recognizes danger long before the conscious mind gives it a name? What if self-reports measure or explain the emotion, try to, but they're not actually telling you what the emotion is itself because they don't know? What if physiology is measuring one layer, but behavior is measuring another, and self-reports are measuring another? So you've got physiology, behavior, and self-reports. Maybe that's why psychology has been so difficult, not because science is poor, but the subject is unbelievably complex and hard to measure, right? We're trying to measure something that doesn't exist as one simple thing. People are complex. Perhaps what we call emotion is really a combination of physiology, subconscious processing and programming, conscious interpretation, memory, patterns, what we've experienced in the past, personality, and social context, and even more than that. If that's all true, no single measurement could ever tell the whole story. What's our 90-day insight? When I finished reading this paper, I realized it wasn't really about emotions for me. It was more about the measurement of these things. Good science isn't simply collecting more data. Good science is constantly asking, what exactly did we measure? What didn't we measure? How confident should we be before drawing conclusions? I like the direction the paper is taking, that studying people in everyday life should teach us things that laboratories never could. But moving into the real world doesn't eliminate the measurement problem. In many ways, it may make the measurement problem even more important. I'll leave you with one final thought in this segment. A survey tells us what people say. Physiology tells us what the body is doing. Behavior tells us what people actually did. Perhaps the future of psychology isn't choosing one over the others. Perhaps it's kind of learning how all three fit together, because every measurement reveals something, but no single measurement reveals everything.
Victoria experiences the past, present, and future while sleeping. Will she be able to decipher the mystery of the symbols, messages, and images of her dreams before it is too late? Discover the lives she lives while Victoria dreams.
Soon she went on a perfect date, and then she knew it must be fate. In just 90 days, that is all it took. How she found her match? It is in the book.
Welcome back to 90 Day Soulmate. Before the break, we explored a question that sounds deceptively simple. How do we know what we know? More specifically, what exactly are we measuring? We discovered that measuring emotion isn't nearly as simply as asking a question, how do you feel? Between the emotion and the answer, a great deal may happen. Memory gets involved. Personality gets involved. Self-image gets involved. Social expectations get involved. So let's take the next step. If laboratories don't perfectly represent everyday life, how do psychologists study emotion in the real world? That's exactly where this paper begins taking us. The authors argue that the future of emotion research isn't abandoning the laboratory, it's expanding beyond it. Researchers are increasingly studying people where emotions naturally occur, at work, at home, while driving, during conversations, and through ordinary daily life. At first glance, that sounds like that makes a lot of common sense. Of course, emotions happen in everyday life, but scientifically, it's a major shift. Laboratories give us control. Everyday life gives us complexity. Laboratories remove distractions. Everyday life refuses to cooperate. Got to wrestle it to the ground. The question is no longer, can we measure emotion? The question becomes, can we measure emotion without changing it by simply studying it? So when we study something, does that change what we're studying? capture the moment. Let me ask you something. What were you feeling last Tuesday at exactly 2:17 in the afternoon? No, not in the morning, not yesterday, last Tuesday at exactly 2:17. Could you answer that? Probably not with much confidence because you're forgetful. And it's not that, but memory doesn't work the way most people think it does. We tend to think of memory as a recording, almost like people replaying a movie, but it isn't. It's constructed. It's reconstructed. It's not replayed. We only remember bits and pieces. Every time you remember something, your brain has to rebuild it. Some details are clearer, others fade away, and sometimes the meaning changes without us even noticing it. Sometimes what we're remembering never even happened. That's a real challenge for psychology. If I ask you how you felt last Tuesday, am I measuring your original emotion? Am I measuring your memory? Researchers had the same question. So they developed something called ecological momentary assessment. Forget the name, it's a simple idea. Instead of asking you next week, your phone asks you right now, how are you feeling? Right now. What are you thinking? Right now. What's happening to you? Right now. Instead of collecting one memory, researchers collect dozens of moments. Not one big picture, lots of tiny little snapshots. Does it solve every problem? No. People can still misunderstand themselves, still answer the way they think they should, still struggle to explain what they're feeling, but it does solve one important problem. It reduces the time from the experience and the measurement. It gets rid of that time error, that memory error. Is real life better science? What does this mean to me? What does it mean to you? When you hear something about a new study, ask whether it reflects the complexity of everyday life or only a carefully controlled, architected situation in a laboratory. Let's think about this for a minute. Suppose I ask you how you're feeling while you're sitting quietly inside a psychological or psychology laboratory or psychological tests, right? So now I suppose the exact same thing and the same question, I pose it to you while you're driving home. You're running late, you're paying attention to traffic, your phone keeps ringing, and someone just cut you off. Which one is more real? Probably the second one, but the first one's much easier to study. That's the dilemma psychologists have been wrestling for decades. Inside the laboratory, researchers control the temperature, the lighting, the timing, the distractions, sometimes even the conversations. They can isolate one variable at a time. Real life doesn't cooperate that way. Real life includes sleep, financial pressure, unexpected phone calls, family disagreements, again, traffic, good news and bad news throughout the day, and 100 little interruptions that you weren't expecting. Laboratories spend years trying to eliminate these things. Here's the fascinating questions. What if those interruptions aren't the problem? What if they're actually part of the answer? Maybe emotions aren't meant to be studied in isolation. Maybe they're meant to be studied in context of the situation. That's one central idea, right? It's incorporated in this paper. Rather than asking people to leave their everyday lives to be studied in a laboratory, researchers are beginning to study the emotions while everyday life is actually happening. I kind of like that direction. If 10 things happened before you answered the question, which one actually influenced your emotion? Was it the traffic, lack of sleep, the argument, the deadline, the weather, or was it some combination of all of them? The experiment can become more realistic, the measurements become richer, but discovering cause and effect may become even more difficult. And I think that's the price we pay for more real-life information, for bringing psychology out of the laboratory into the real world. We're talking about three different measurements. One of the things I enjoyed most about the paper is that it just doesn't look at emotions through one window. It begins combining several different kinds of measurements, each telling us something unique. The first is the environmental context. Where are you? What are you doing? Who are you with? Are you at work? Are you home? Driving through traffic? or relaxing on vacation. Those things matter. The second, though, is physiological. It's measurements that are the heart rate, breathing, skin conductivity, body temperature, and perhaps they can even look at brain activity and body chemistry. These measurements tell us what the body is doing, whether we recognize it consciously or not. Then the third measurement is the person's own description. How are you feeling? What are you experiencing? What does this emotion feel like to you? Now, think about what we've just done. We're no longer relying on one source of information. We're comparing the environment, the body's physiological response, and the person's conscious interpretation. Do all three of these agree? Well, apparently not. And that's exactly what makes this type of research so interesting. Instead of asking which one is correct, and maybe if any are correct, maybe we should be asking, which is the one telling us what the others cannot? What can we learn from each? I think that's where psychology becomes more than just asking questions. It begins assembling evidence from several independent sources to better understand one very complicated human experience. Is there another measurement that might be useful in this thing, in the way these experiments are conducted? What does this mean to me? Don't judge progress only by how you feel today. Look at what actually changed in your life. Sometimes your behavior changes before your feelings catch up. Up to this point, we've talked about three different sources of information: the environment, physiological measurements, and the participant's own self-report. I think the three contribute something valuable, but I keep wondering whether there's another source of evidence that deserves more attention, much more attention. Observable behavior. Not simply what people say, what they actually do. Suppose a company redesigns an office. They introduce more natural light, add green spaces, improve temperatures, create quiet areas for focused work, provide better places for collaboration. Now suppose they measure the results. Employee absenteeism decreases, productivity improves, customer complaints decline, and employees make fewer mistakes. That's interesting. Notice they didn't begin by asking everyone, "Do you feel happier?" Instead, they observe measurable changes in behavior. Does that prove that the new environment caused the improvements? Not necessarily. There could be other explanations, but it does provide another independent source of evidence. Now imagine combining all four. The environment changed, physiological measurements changed, people report feeling differently, and there's observable behavior that changed. When several independent measurements begin pointing in the same directions, my confidence in the conclusion may naturally increase. Not only because any one measurement proves the answer, but because independent sources of evidence are supporting the same conclusion. I think that's where psychology becomes especially interesting. Instead of asking which measurement is best, perhaps we should be asking each other of what measurements help us better understand the same human experience. I think this is where I fit into psychology best. My specialization is industrial and organizational psychology, which has to do a lot with the system, the environment, and how that impacts behavior. With more measurements, do we get better understanding? At first glance, it seems like the perfect solution. Measure the environment, measure the physiological response, collect the self-reports, and observe behavior, and we can solve the problem. But it's not that simple. More measurement doesn't automatically produce better understanding. It just gives us more pieces to a puzzle. It takes much more difficult time putting together more pieces, doesn't it? If all those pieces, though, point in the same direction, give us the same image, the environment changes, heart rate decreases, people feel less stressed, and absenteeism drops, I'll have a lot more confidence in that conclusion. But if they don't agree, What if physiological measurements suggest higher stress, but people insist they're perfectly calm, everything's great? What if productivity improves, but employees report lower job satisfaction? What if people say they're happy, but absenteeism continues to increase? I don't see them as failures. I see them as opportunities to ask better questions. Maybe each measurement is capable of offering information on a different part of the same human experience. The environment tells us what changed. Physiological measurements tell us how the body responded. Self-reports tell us how people interpreted the experience. And the observable behavior tells us what people actually did. Maybe the goal isn't to find one perfect measurement. Maybe the goal is to understand what each measurement contributes to the answer and where the limitations are. To me, that's what good science looks like. Not just collecting more data, but understanding what the data actually means. Leaving the laboratory, getting into the real world. One thing I appreciated about this paper is that it doesn't pretend that there's a perfect solution. It simply argues that if we want to understand real emotions, we have to study people living real lives. I agree with that, but every improvement comes with a trade-off. Inside a laboratory, researchers control the environment. Outside the laboratory, the environment controls the researcher. People don't schedule their emotions. Life simply happens. A difficult meeting, an unexpected compliment, good news from a friend, a flat tire, a child's phone call, or a financial surprise. Yay! My 401k is now a 201k. Any one of those may influence the measurements. Now the researcher has another question to answer. Did the event we're studying change the emotion? Or was it something else that happened that day? Maybe the participant argued with a spouse before leaving home. And now the study, the questions, the things that happened triggered them because they were already set up to be angry. Maybe they didn't sleep well. Maybe they received the wonderful news just before the study began. None of these experiences were actually part of the experiment, but all of them became part of that person's day, and any of them could influence the measurements. That is what makes this real-life studying so fascinating. The researcher may begin looking at one event while the participant is living through 20 others. I don't think moving into the real world makes psychology easier. I think it makes it more realistic, and realism almost completely comes with greater complexity. To me, that's not a weakness of the research. It's simply the price we pay for studying people as they really live, instead of studying them in carefully controlled laboratories. Maybe it also stops relying on self-reports. Is all this information, all this data real, or is it just noise? The interruptions in your day may not be simply distractions. They may be part of the reason you're feeling what you're feeling. Researchers often use the word noise to describe things that make an experiment more difficult to interpret. And it's an interesting word, right? Noise suggests something unwanted, something that gets in the way. Something we'd prefer to remove from the experiment. But let's think about that for a minute. Suppose you're studying emotions in everyday life. Is traffic really a noise? Is poor sleep really a noise? Is an unexpected compliment or a comment or a disagreement with a friend noise? Or is it simply something we'd like to eliminate? Are those things part of everyday emotional life? And what we've been calling noise is actually information, information about the person's environment, their relationships, their responsibilities, and the countless experiences that influence emotions every day. That's one of the reasons I find this paper so fascinating. It doesn't simply encourage researchers to collect more measurements. It encourages them to study emotions where they naturally occur. Even though, when doing so, it could make the science more difficult. Complex systems are difficult to study. Weather is complicated. Financial markets are complicated. And human emotions may be among the most complicated systems we'll ever try to understand or never understand. That doesn't mean we shouldn't simplify emotions until they're easier to study. It means we need better ways of studying complexity. And we need to do that without losing the very thing we're trying to understand. I believe that's the direction this paper is pointing us in. Science is an absolute. It's not a destination. It's a process. It's always questioning itself. One of the things I hope people take away from this discussion is that uncertainty isn't a weakness of science. It's actually built in. It's part of science. Every good study answers some questions and raises a lot of new ones. That's exactly what this paper has done for me. It didn't convince me that we've solved the problem of measuring emotions. It convinced me that we're now asking better questions and we're collecting more data, potentially evidence, and maybe even some proof. But science rarely moves from wrong to right. It more often moves from simpler explanations to better explanations, from one measurement to several independent measurements, from controlled laboratories to carefully observed real-life field experiments. Each step teaches us something. Each step also reminds us how much we still have to learn. To me, that's one of the most exciting parts of science. Not reaching the finish line, but realizing there probably isn't one. Every answer becomes the starting point for the next question. And perhaps that's exactly why psychology continues to evolve. Not because earlier researchers failed, and sometimes they did, but because every generation develops better tools, asks better questions, and gradually sees a little more of the picture than the generation before it. The goal of science is uncertainty. As I finished reading the paper, I found myself thinking less about emotions and more about how we do science. Sometimes people expect science to provide certainty. I don't, and it's proven year after year that it doesn't. I expect science to reduce uncertainty, give us some tips and hints and suggestions. These things aren't the same thing, reducing uncertainty and gaining certainty. Every new measurement, every better instrument, every improved research method helps us understand better, helps us understand a little more than we did before, and reduce uncertainty. That doesn't mean we finally found the answer. It simply means we've asked a better question. I like the direction that the paper took, that moving beyond the laboratory, combining environmental context, physiological measurements, and self-reports, it's all a meaningful step forward. I'd like to see this conversation continue. I'd like to see more emphasis on observable behavior, more objective measurements, and more independent sources of evidence that either support, challenge, either one, support or challenge the conclusions. Because that's how confidence grows, not by collecting one more questionnaire, but by asking whether completely different kinds of evidence are leading us towards the same conclusion.
Victoria experiences the past, present, and future while sleeping. Will she be able to decipher the mystery of the symbols, messages, and images of her dreams before it is too late? Discover the lives she lives while Victoria dreams.
Soon she went on a perfect date, and then she knew it must be fate. In just 90 days, that is all it took. How she found her match, it is in the book.
Welcome back to 90 Day Soulmate. Throughout today's program, we've used one research paper as our launch point. But the larger discussion has really been about measurement. How do we know we're measuring what we think we're measuring? That's a question every science eventually asks. Medicine asks it. Engineering asks it. Psychology asks it. And I'm asking it. Emotions are especially interesting because we can't measure them directly. Oh, you've got 186 pounds of emotion. No, we can't do that. We can't weigh them. We can't put them on a scale or look at them under a microscope. We can't count them. Instead, we need to measure the evidence surrounding the emotions. What's the environment like? What's the body's physiology, the heart rate? What's going on with the conductivity of the skin? Our behavior, how people are acting, and our self-reports, how we report we feel. We take those pieces and put them together and ask, what story are they telling? It may be the biggest lesson I took from this paper. We're not measuring emotion itself. We're measuring the evidence that helps us understand it. Let's look another way at this idea. Imagine standing outside a house. One window lets you see into the kitchen. Another looks into the living room. Another looks from the backyard or overlooks, right? The backyard, but from the backyard you can see in it. Each window tells you something. None of them shows you the entire house. I think psychology works the same way. Environment is one window. Physiology is another window. Self-reports are another. Behavior gives us yet another view. No single measurement tells us the whole story, but when several independent observations begin pointing in the same direction, hey, you're looking at a house, our confidence naturally increases. Not because one measurement proved anything, but because these different perspectives are beginning to agree. When environment, when physiology, when how someone says they're feeling and their behavior match up, we then can start to say maybe what they're saying, maybe what we're seeing does make sense. When measurements disagree, though, this is really interesting. It's, you know, very interesting when measurements don't agree. Suppose the physiological measurements that we're taking about somebody's emotions show that they have stress, but the participant reports feeling perfectly calm. Who's right? Their body or their mind? Or what they're saying? Maybe both. Maybe the body is responding to something entirely different than what we think we're measuring. And maybe it responds before the conscious mind has fully interpreted that. Perhaps they're measuring different parts of the same experience. Instead of asking which one is correct, maybe the better question is, what is each one trying to tell us? Sometimes disagreement isn't a mistake, is not a mistake, right? Sometimes it's the beginning of deeper understanding. So we need better questions. The more I thought about this paper, the more I realized good research just doesn't provide answers. It can teach us how to ask better questions. Suppose one researcher relies on only self-reports. Another combines self-reports and physiology and environment and observable behavior. Which conclusion would you trust more? When they discuss the evidence, when they discuss the data, which one can give you a deeper picture? Probably the second one, right? Not because it's guaranteed to be correct or right, but it examines the same question from several different independent directions. That's how confidence grows. How we can use this in our own life is that when we're witnessing the behavior and the feelings of someone else, it's not only what they tell us. It can be their actions, the environment. It can be their physiology, their facial expression. It could also be if you actually understand the environment they're in, you may understand how they're feeling. Let's get back to the bird tunnel. I gave you an example of the bird tunnel before. So I worked on bird-safe glass. The industry developed this tunnel test, which it's an excellent laboratory test. It's fast, it's repeatable. You can test one piece of glass against a standard. The actual test is standardized. But I kept wondering, does flying through this tunnel at these two pieces of glass and a bird making a decision actually represent what a bird sees in real life? Is it a real world experience for the bird? Outside there are trees, there are reflections, there are changing skies, there's weather, there's predators chasing them, there's countless distractions of things going around. Maybe they got a phone call. No, I'm kidding, they didn't get a phone call. The tunnel measures something important. It just doesn't measure everything. Psychology faces the same challenge. Laboratories answer some questions beautifully, but unfortunately, real life asks many more than the laboratory can handle. Confidence. What is your confidence in the answer? People often ask, can you prove it? As we talked about earlier on, that science really rarely and really rarely gives you absolute proof. It gradually builds confidence in something until someone questions it and tears it down, and then another theory comes along. Unless these are universal things that withstand the test of time. The next time you hear someone say, research proves, try asking yourself one simple question. What other independent evidence supports that conclusion? One study is interesting, but several independent observations that point in the same direction, that's more convincing. And again, in psychology, we're not looking for proof as much as evidence that there's a tendency that things tend to do this and that in these directions, because people are different and conclusions are based upon best evidence, best data. And science evolves. That's one thing I appreciate about science. It never really stands still. It's always changing. That every generation develops better tools. They develop better measurements, better questions. That's exactly what I see in the paper itself. It's not rejecting earlier research of just laboratory emotion studies, right? Studies on emotion. It's building on top of it. It's actually building outside the building. That's how every healthy science grows, questioning what was and saying what could be. The real lesson, as I look back on today's discussion, I don't think the biggest lesson is about emotions itself. It's about the evidence of emotions. It's how we can gather data on people's emotions. Every measurement contributes something. Every measurement, though, has its limitations. The challenge isn't deciding which one is best. The challenge is understanding what each one contributes to the conversation. So why does this all matter? What does this mean for you? The next time you hear about a new study, read a headline, watch the news, someone says, hey, this research study just proved research. Proving, study, shows, you probably need to pause for a moment and ask a different question. What did they measure? That one question may completely change the way you evaluate information. How did they go about the study? What did they measure? What backing other information tends to point in the same direction? As we finish today's discussion, we again began with a paper about emotions, moving research from the lab out into the environment, out into where real life happens. We ended up with a question about evidence itself. And that's the real value of today's conversation, that good science isn't just collecting more data. We talked about self-reports, which is used all the time in psychology. Talked about physiology, right? Testing skin, pulse, heart rates, blood pressure, different things in understanding. It's just not collecting more data, but it's understanding what the data represents. What does high blood pressure represent? Is it just somebody who's poor nutrition, or does it mean something with stress? So the next time someone says, research proves, pause and ask yourself, what exactly did they measure? because the quality of our conclusions will never be better than the quality of our measurements. Stay curious, keep asking good questions, never stop learning. Thanks for tuning in.
You're listening to 90 Day Soulmate with the relationship engineers, Jim Golnick and Lisette Guevara, only on LA Talk Radio.